Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and sitting next to me is James. Before we get started, maybe you should check out part one of this podcast if you haven't yet. We talked about Seinfeld and the first part of our Seinfeld podcast. I don't know. TheMacGuffinMen.com. Follow us on Twitter. And yeah, you know, theme song.
Yep.
Seinfeld, part two. Let's do this.
Yeah.
Okay. So, the pilot. But not like the pilot.
Not the pilot of Seinfeld, the pilot of Jerry.
Exactly. The one with Jeremy Piven.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's the end of season four.
Yes.
And it's Seinfeld kind of reflexive in many, self-reflexive in many ways. Mm-hmm. And this is the plot line that kind of is the most inward looking, I guess. It's about comedian Jerry Seinfeld starting a sitcom at NBC based on his own life, where he's going to play a slightly fictionalized version of himself. Mm-hmm. So kind of cutting edge, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, Bob Balaban, I mean, this is a plot line that runs all throughout the season.
Yes.
Not like, you know, not even every episode, like they go four or five episodes without even mentioning it sometimes, you know. But yeah, it's sort of a season capper sort of thing. And it is something that is a thread throughout season four. And also Bob Balaban playing a character that's supposed to be Warren Littlefield, you know, like to the point where he went to the upfronts as like pretending to be like the character that he was in place of Warren Littlefield.
Yes, which the is NBC executive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and as you said, it is a thread that runs throughout the entire series, is them getting picked up, or, you know, them trying to get picked up for the show and working on the pilot. And, you know, we kind of see it a few more times throughout the entire series. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the impetus for the finale is that, it's, you know, a new someone new at NBC likes their show and wants to air it. Mm-hmm. And gives the 13-episode order. And so there's a lot of reflection on kind of what it was like to start making Seinfeld when we see them starting to make Jerry. Some of this, you know, similar complaints from the network about not enough happening, things like that being played out on screen.
Yep.
I particularly like a lot of that kind of meta stuff, so I thought this plot line was very interesting. And because so much of the show Seinfeld is about Jerry's life, it was kind of just the next logical step that, a few seasons into it, he is someone who now has to deal with this television deal. And I thought that was very, very cool to see. And, you know, I was so young when this was coming out, I don't think I could really appreciate what that was. And it's not as though this is the first time an actor has played themselves or someone very similar to themselves on television or in film or anything like that. I still think it is really cool. And I'm, you know, part of why we do this podcast is that television production and things like that is something that interests me and something you're involved in. And I think it's just a really cool thing to see. You know, it's one of the few times we get a non-sappy montage in, faux sappy montage in Seinfeld is when they're starting up the filming of the show and they're turning all the lights and cameras on and setting up the set and things like that. So from that standpoint, I think it's really interesting, but just also kind of that meta narrative of them making the show about, you know, what is essentially the show you're watching, I think, has always been something very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And especially this is like 1992 or 93 when it's airing, right? Yeah. Very uncommon thing. You know?
Yeah.
We're in a pre-Charlie Kaufman world.
Yeah, we are. And I mean, we're in a pre-Curb world. Obviously, it's a straight line between the two, and Larry David was heavily involved. But as you said, this is something that runs throughout this season. And that is something that Larry David was a big fan of. And if you've watched Curb, you can kind of see one of the many ways it's similar to The Wire is that there are kind of season-long arcs in so many sitcoms are, you know, episode by episode, you can watch them all jumbled up. This is one that there is kind of that through line, and we get them writing it and then having meetings and then casting the show and then filming the show and things like that. So it is this bigger thread that exists in this season.
Yeah, and also Seinfeld in general, like, I think more than shows that have come before it or that came before it really references its own past a lot, but it does, and which is something that's very common in television shows now, because it's just sort of it's assumed that your audience has a more more detailed knowledge of what came before it simply because they can rewatch it whenever they want now.
Yeah.
Whereas the way Seinfeld does it, even when they're just referring to things that have happened in previous episodes, even seasons before, they have to do it in a much more broad way, yeah, simply because, you know, it's harder to see these episodes multiple times. And also since it's something, it's like that reference that we talked about, the atomic wedgie thing with the multiple cuts that we think has to be a reference to something we just haven't seen. Whereas Seinfeld, like, they wanted to make sure you knew it was a reference, even if you didn't remember that episode, just because it was so new. Or, you know, at least kind of new. And yeah, you are correct. Like, the way that Seinfeld operates as kind of this 9-season organism, as opposed to just how many, whatever, 200 episodes, you know, like, just separate from each other. And the way characters are able to come back, come in and out, like Tina, Elaine's roommate, comes in like 3 seasons removed or something.
I love her so
much. Oh, she's
much.
So funny. She's so funny.
I've always liked her. I was blown away this time. Her first appearance is so funny to me. I can't even get over it.
She had such a great improv class.
Yeah, I know. And something about one-shouldered shirts I've always found very funny to me.
Oh, that's another thing that is just very prevalent throughout Seinfeld, is that fashion in the 90s for women was so unfortunate. Like, for men, it wasn't much better, but... yeah, God, some of the things Elaine has to wear.
I know.
Such a bummer.
Yeah. One of the things that I do enjoy a lot is Jerry kind of identifying that he is a bad actor, and that he knows it, and that people at NBC know it, and things like that. But he's just such an important factor in the show that there's just no way around it. And I thought that was always really funny. And I just think that there is... It's really obvious that this... show is about, I mean, that these episodes are about the show Seinfeld. You know, it's so on the nose, it's so obvious. And I just think doing those kinds of jokes and making them so blatant and things like that really set, you know, you can draw a straight line from there to, you know, Community and Arrested Development jokes, you know, kind of about themselves or about television production or about how their order got cut for how many episodes in a season. And I mean, this is so bang on, it's clear, it's all right there. You don't have to do any, you know, digging around, but, you know, you just have to think that Dan Harmon and Mitch Hurwitz and people who've been involved with shows that often are self-reflexive and look at themselves and make jokes about themselves in a very meta way, you know, this has to have been a pretty influential thing for them.
Yeah. Oh, of course. I mean, it was Seinfeld.
Yeah, exactly. No,
it was the biggest thing on television that was also, and it was also something like really, really good, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so it's going to be pretty influential.
I find Bob Balaban's kind of wasted.
I mean, Bob Balaban's always kind of wasted. Yeah. That's kind of like the Bob Balaban thing.
He's just so funny and he just doesn't get a lot to do.
Yeah. No, that's fair. Another very talented man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. He's great and everything and fine in this, you know. It's like you said, he doesn't get a lot to do.
Crazy Joe Davola.
Yeah, Six Semper Tyrannus.
And you know, just I don't even think we've mentioned this, but we have George as our stand-in for Larry David, and the characters, you know, based around him, and he's the one writing this NBC show with Jerry, and I think he just gets even more reasons to be Larry David in this, and you know, saying things about the raisins and things like that just seem such the Larry David thing to do. And I think this whole arc really brings out a lot of Larry David, because you've heard so many of the stories about how he worked in television and how he dealt with people like that. And this one really just puts all of that in the spotlight, because the stories you hear about Larry David are him working in television. Now here's a plot line about our stand-in for Larry David working in television. So it's just that Larry David was so important to this show. And so for him to kind of get, you know, the spotlight, this very negative spotlight, it just really kind of rounds out the show, as Jerry was in front of the camera and as well as behind it. It's not that he didn't have anything to do. You know, he's not there for his acting. but it really puts Larry David in the forefront, and I think he just was such a creative driving force for this show that this plot line really kind of puts him out there in a way that I think deserves recognition.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of like, I still like, I think there's a 50-50 level of importance for each of them, but I think like the highest points that Seinfeld reaches, it certainly feels are more, at least from my perspective, feels more like the Larry David stuff. It's the stuff that really like takes it up an extra, like when I really love something, it always feels like something Larry David was
behind. Yeah, okay, you know? I see what you mean.
Yeah. But yeah, just for the show as an overall whole, I think, you know, they probably deserve equal credit for its existence. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Jeremy Piven.
And Super Jeremy Piven. And the man playing Kramer in the show is someone who auditioned to be Kramer and didn't get the part. So
I think Mariska Hegarty, or however you say her last name, auditioned to be Elaine.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And
she's super funny in that episode too.
Yeah, she is. And that's one of Jerry's best breakups, I think. Okay, anything else about the pilot? Or
No, I don't have a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. So the marine biologist.
Yeah. Did you pick this one or is that me?
I think I did.
Okay. I thought so too. I would have picked it, I think, if you hadn't.
Well, there were some on your list that I, like the pen, I didn't, that was on your list, that I like removed from my list because I assumed you wouldn't have anything in it, you know? And there were some things on your list that surprised me and, but like in a good way. But the marine biologist, I definitely wanted to talk about because it's amazing. Like, again, watching this episode, this is an episode I didn't know anything about. Yeah. So it was like, it was beautiful. It was this beautiful, like unopened box of comedy white whale, perfection. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just so funny.
What's so strong about it?
Everything, the way, like, it opens with a really funny Jerry bit, like Jerry acting. Like he's talking about Golden Boy. Like, he has a few moments throughout the show, and I love it when Jerry, like, as an actor is really great. Like, even aside from the lines that he's saying, like, the way that he performs them is really funny.
Yeah.
And every time he talks about Golden Boy is great. And it's like what we talked about, and I think this episode is one of the prime examples of it. What you talked about with the pen, where every line sort of ties into something that came before it. And even, like, they had to go into the tag to wrap everything up.
Yeah,
know? Like,
I know.
And they wrap up everything. Like, even the last thing that Jerry and Elaine are talking about is the death of Golden Boy.
Yeah.
Which is the first thing talked about in the episode. And the fact that all of it is so funny. Like,
yeah.
And the reveal of the title, like, George's last speech is amazing.
Yeah. It's on there word for word on the Wikipedia page.
Is it really?
Yeah. It's so undeniably a good little soliloquy that...
And actually, there's another good example. Kramer's speech about the 600 Titleists, yeah. Like, where he just comes and, do you want to have some fun? Yeah. Like, that, and what we talked about with Bookman, like, Seinfeld was such a performer show sometimes in that it would give you this page of a monologue. And it's just like, it's just something so huge for an actor to just really sink their teeth into. And people like Philip Baker Hall and Michael Richards and Jason Alexander, are just so talented that they're able to do so much with these things. And that 600 Titleist thing is just like, it's so marvelous to me.
Yeah.
And like, I love excited Kramer. It's like, he's playing that episode like he's Oprah, or sorry, that speech like he's Oprah.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. And also the conversation, or the few interjections that Jerry and George have are really great. Like, George, like, I'm just lying, I don't want to actually have any fun. And Jerry's saying, oh, I really want to have some fun.
Yeah, you know? No, like, I think it's so emblematic of those two. Like, Jerry is not a super optimistic person. We've talked about how this is kind of a dark, bleak show in general.
Yeah.
But Jerry seems to think that there is hope, and he's pointing out these things in the hope of things maybe getting better someday, where George just seems so resigned to how negative everything is. Yeah. Jerry's like, yeah, I really do want to have fun. Yeah. Like, he's surprised by his optimism because he's not a super optimistic person, but he says, you know, that I really do want to have fun. And that is my genuine answer. Like, I still kind of feel like that's Jerry saying there is hope in the world, and that, you know, things are a little broken, but maybe they're going to get better and I can still enjoy some things in this life, where George is just going through the motions and not killing himself. Like, that's just the best he has. And yeah, that really positive Kramer that you see sometimes is great. So that's good. And as we said, the conclusion's just fantastic.
Yeah, the conclusion speech and then the reveal of the golf ball is amazing and made me laugh so hard.
Yeah.
And because I didn't see it coming, and like, everything about the episode was just so wonderful. And since it was so fresh, even despite the fact that it comes during Seinfeld's heyday, what people probably recognize as such.
Yeah.
I was watching it and was like, I feel so lucky to be in a world where this was bequeathed upon me.
Well, it's funny that you hadn't seen it and that it kind of came to you as this one, you know, episode among a bunch of them, because as you pointed out, it is what I feel is such a complete episode. Like everything's brought up and then everything's tied up so well. And we discussed earlier about how, especially later on, we get these separate, you know, sometimes an A, B, C, D, and plot line all coming together.
Mm-hmm.
This is the best tying two storylines together. And because it's so late and because it has such a good payoff and the speech is so good, but then you have that visual joke of the golf ball reveal. Golden Boy, you know, being the Iron Man and then, you know, kind of starting to fray and then being dead by the end of it.
Yeah.
It is just, it is this little pod, like this complete front to back, everything in it, it just works with each other so well.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually think this episode turn is really influential in the way that later season Seinfeld went, because it's one of the first episodes where something so big and insane happens.
Yeah.
Which really starts to happen more frequently in later seasons.
Yeah.
And I think this is the episode where it's the first time they actually kind of tried it and it worked so well that they sort of felt a confidence in, you know, getting bigger as the show went on.
Yeah.
And that would have happened naturally, I think, anyway, but this is what I think turned out to be a very influential episode in the rest of, you know, the show.
And it got such a huge response at the time, like from the audience, like it, they knew it was kind of something big and wasn't just a little bit. And as you said, they don't do this. This was still when they were regularly doing the Jerry stand-up ending.
Yeah.
And no, we just kind of skip that because there's a bit more story to tell and it has to just be wrapped up so neatly. And it is.
Yeah. And it also, George's storyline deals a lot with when to be honest and when to not be honest, which I think is something that Seinfeld dips into a lot. Like when you can be honest and when you can't be. And a lot of times in the show, we see specifically Jerry being honest in situations where people are typically not honest. And not necessarily working out poorly for Jerry, but hurting somebody, you know, like,
yeah.
I think there's so many instances throughout the show where Jerry is honest in a situation where people typically aren't. But George actually like seeing the benefits of being dishonest and it actually working out. And then when he finally does decide to be honest, it just doesn't work out.
Yeah.
You know, like
go to hell. Yeah. Took the bus home.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's kind of interesting in that, he was being dishonest in a way that seems impossible to actually be able to follow through on. And then he does.
Yeah.
And then he gains the confidence to actually be honest about who he is. And then is immediately sent home on the bus.
Yeah. And I think that it speaks to one of the things that I think is so dark and depressing and pessimistic about the show, even though there are a lot of things that do that.
Mm-hmm.
This is one example, and there's probably better ones, but of your friends and your relationships having a negative impact on you. Like, it's so many times that these plot lines do start to converge that it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that people are terrible. You know, that, you know, there's the line, people are the worst.
that's one of the lines that I said earlier, how like some things just so accurately reflect how I feel. That conversation between Elaine and Jerry, like, I just, there's such like a truth to it.
Yeah.
I just really feel it. Anyway, so.
No, just that there's, you share this world with people and interacting with them makes your life worse.
Yeah.
And you live in a society where you have to deal with these people. And these are your friends. You're choosing to deal with these people. But they have this negative effect on your life, sometimes on purpose, in this case, pretty accidentally. As you said, Kramer hitting this golf ball into a whale's blowhole. A fish or a whale? George doesn't know.
It's a mammal.
It gave George this confidence to get through this deception, and it just totally backfired right away.
Yep.
And it's just one of the very dark things about this show is that even the people you choose to spend time with are awful and bad for you and making your life worse, and there's just no good relationships in the world. And it's such a dark,
there's no flawless relationship.
Well, it's just such a dark message that it gets leaned on over and over, and very rarely do these kind of plot convergences end up positively for our main characters. And that goes without saying that their effect on the people outside of the main cast of the show is often extremely negative.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we see that the most with Susan Ross. Well, yeah. Yeah.
The opposite?
Yeah, the opposite.
Yeah.
You're a fan?
Oh, this is one of my episodes. This is another one of the top three to me.
Okay.
I love it so much. It's
this is where George, as you kind of mentioned earlier, very early on in season one, goes for doing the exact opposite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Where he just sort of, he has realized that every instinct that he's had throughout his life is just wrong, so he's just going to do the opposite. And then life immediately starts working out for him, and basically Elaine and George switch places. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that so much because I like the way his plot is handled because it starts from such like a real like realization, or not even realization so much as maybe just thought process that I think every thinking adult would have at some point in their life, where it's just like, what if everything I've done is wrong? Like, you just, even if you have a relatively easy life, which George kind of does, he's unemployed frequently, but other than that, he's doing all right. He has his help, despite the fact he doesn't care about that. But it is just like, but you still have these moments where you're going to think like, what if everything is wrong? Like, life could be so much better maybe. And it's him playing with that for the whole episode. And I think it working out in a really funny way. The thing I like even more about that, or even more about the episode, is Jerry's plot line, where he's quote unquote even Steven, where anything that bad that happens to him immediately, pretty much immediately evens out. Like, he loses a gig and then immediately gets a call for another gig that weekend. Elaine throws his $20 out the window, and then he finds $20 in an old coat.
Which is some great Elaine too.
Oh, so good. The face she makes, it just holds on it. But yeah, I find that so interesting because I find that it's a really, it's one of the only times, and it does it not explicitly, it explains Jerry's worldview. It's that he's able to sit in the corner of the room and analyze everything and find a joke in everything.
Yeah.
Because nothing bad has ever happened to him. You know, like, he's, and you see this a lot. I find my friends, the people that are the most prone to making like jokes about topics that are generally like off the board or something, are people that have never had to deal with like real struggle, you know. Yeah. like I've had a pretty easy life, so I'm you know, I'm more okay with some more let's say Anthony Jeselnik jokes, you know, like,
yep,
just because nothing bad has ever happened to me, none of those jokes ever relate to me personally. You know, and I think that's something that really says a lot about Seinfeld as a whole, is that all of these characters have relatively easy lives. And it is because they've had easy lives where everything has just kind of gone right for them that they're able to just talk shit about everything bad that happens in the world without caring, because it's never actually affected them.
Well, you know? I think that applies the most to Jerry.
It definitely applies the most to Jerry, but I think it applies a lot to Elaine too. I find Elaine in general to be a fascinating character because of the main four, she's the person that feels the most like a real person.
Yeah.
And part of that, like, I think Jerry would be at least close, but Seinfeld's actual performance is just so, it's just so Jerry Seinfeld that it's just such a performance, whereas Julia Louis-Dreyfus is just such a natural performer. And I think it's because she's so talented that Elaine is always like a way worse person than she comes off as being in the show, you know, just because I think there's such a naturalism to Elaine. I find Elaine so interesting because she feels like people I know, especially in the sort of like wannabe progressive stuff that you get a lot of with her. Like, it's, she's like, oh no, I'm really, really progressive, until it starts like hindering her in any way. And then she'll just do whatever ends up being the best for her at the time.
Yeah.
And I think that Elaine today is the character that still really resonates with me as far as being an actual reflection of society. And the even Steven plotline, I think, really ties in to a lot of the things that I love about Seinfeld.
Yeah, and I mean, Jerry, you know, got where he was because observational comedy. He doesn't tell, you know, like personal anecdotes so much, or, you know, his struggles with his parents or kids so much. It's just observing how things work, things that he often doesn't have much of a stake in.
Yeah.
Just kind of very general, broad subjects. And, you know, this plot, I think, really drives it home, is that all these other things happen and you can do well or you can do poorly, and these bad things can happen to you or these good things can happen to you. But Jerry's just, you know, in the corner watching all these things happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see that in his style of comedy, but you also see that in this plot line especially, but throughout the show.
Yeah. And also, like, I think there's a good, what I was talking about with Elaine, there's a good example of that. Like, I think if Jerry was to, excuse me, tell, if she did to, or if he did to a girlfriend, what Elaine does in stopping off to get Juju fruits.
Yeah.
Elaine would be like, what is wrong with you? Like, you can't do that. And yet, like, Elaine finds out her boyfriend has been in a car accident and turns around and buys snacks, you know, like, and just because, like, she wanted those Juju fruits and, you know, she's going to get them. And I think just in general, like, Elaine thinks she's a good person, but is a horrible person. And I think that's pretty indicative of real life. Yeah. A lot of times.
Well, so what do you make of Jerry, you know, since we're on this subject, kind of being above everything, like, he, in this way that he's kind of this observer, and that good thing, good and bad things happen to the people around him. He's written as kind of a fantasy character, isn't
yes.
he?
Yes. Oh yeah, definitely. I think so. But I also kind of think that there is still a realism to him. It's just not as much as Elaine to me. You know, like, he's definitely, nothing can touch him. Nothing does touch him throughout the show. You know, he has mild disappointments, and that's about it. Until he ends up in jail, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in the finale, he's saying one of the hardest things he's ever had to do is, like, ration his milk and his cereal, you know? Like, yeah. And I think that's not the hardest thing anybody has ever had to do, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I understand what you mean.
Yeah, no, it's just that he's more successful than all his friends, it seems. You know, he's financially, and he's somewhat of a celebrity. And he kind of has all these good looking women that he can dump for whatever reason he wants, because he knows more are just going to come along.
Yeah, exactly. It's okay. I'll meet somebody else.
Yeah, very positive.
It's been really nice dating you for a while, and good luck.
Yeah, I just didn't know what you thought about him being kind of this power fantasy. I mean, he's such as this superhero, this Superman fan. Mm-hmm. And I think Superman was kind of written as this, you know, power fantasy for young boys who couldn't do much. And yeah, now it's Jerry, who is successful, doesn't seem to work too hard,
yeah,
but is successful, doesn't have really bad things happen to him for the most part. And when they do, they're immediately undone. And, you know, things just go very well for him. And then he has these kind of friends around him who go through these struggles. And there's just kind of a distance between him and most of the proceedings of the show.
Yep.
I just didn't know what you kind of thought about that, taking it out of it, or?
I don't know. I think I just, I don't know. I kind of just see the sort of Even Steven thing, and it just sort of explaining how, like, theoretically something bad could happen to him. It doesn't in the show. And he's just been lucky, so he's able to have this worldview. And I understand what you mean, and I think you're probably right. I think the Superman comparison is apt. yeah, I don't know. I think there's always the potential that something bad could happen and affect him, like he could lose a leg or something, but yeah, it just doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, so he's able to continue to be this, you know?
Yeah.
Like Steve Martin's book, Born Standing Up, like, he talks about how when he was younger, he would make a joke about anything, and then he started to get older, and, you know, and I think the example he uses is that friends start dying from cancer, and so cancer stops being funny to him,
yeah,
you know? And I think Jerry just doesn't have that, you know, as Jerry the character doesn't have anything like that.
Yeah.
You know? Like, Steve Martin goes from the wild and crazy guy to playing a con man in David Mamet movies, you know? Like, he has this transition, you know? And Jerry is just Jerry, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
This is also the coffee table book episode, right?
Yeah, I think it is. I find, like, Regis Philbin very funny. Every time I see him in anything, like, there's just something so funny about him. Like, him calling Kramer Bonko.
Over and over. And the fact that he keeps doing it and it keeps falling flat. Like, it seems that no one is interested. Like, his studio audience and Seinfeld's studio audience doesn't care for that line.
I should have cut to Gelman for a shrug. Or
he just keeps leaning on. I told you this guy's bonkos. Yeah. And I mean, just going with some of the media stuff and kind of being inside television.
Yep.
You know, we get Kramer on another television show, a show that actually exists.
Yeah, exactly.
Not like one of the many fake movies that exist inside the Seinfeld universe.
I mean, that's something I obviously love about Seinfeld is the importance of film to everybody.
Yeah.
Like, they just are watching movies and talking about movies very frequently.
Yeah, because it's one thing, because there's so many, you know, you mentioned the Juju Fruits and the Junior Mints, and he talked about how it's so much funnier that they used real products and that.
Is Juju Fruit a real product?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Juju Fruit, and I mean, so many of the candies and foods and things like that are all real, and he thinks it's funnier because people have had experiences with them, and they recognize them from their real life, and it doesn't take them away. And then for movies, it's a couple real ones, and most, like, whenever they're at the theater, it's fake, except, I mean, George sees Titanic.
Elaine sees The English Patient in one of my favorite Elaine's. That's another... Elaine just being real near and dear to my heart, like seeing a movie that makes everybody cry and being like, what are you talking about?
What's your favorite fake Seinfeld movie?
Oh, I don't know. Like, Rochelle is the one that jumps to mind. Yeah. I think Rochelle is a funny title. But I mean, I haven't, like, weirdly, we have picked episodes that pretty much, with the exception of the Puerto Rican Day, pretty much avoid movies entirely somehow.
That's true.
So, I don't have a really good refresher of them, but I'm sure if I were to look at a list of the titles, I would find a lot that I enjoy.
Did you come across Death Blow?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I watched them all.
Okay.
So, yeah.
We're missing the Death Blow. Like that. And
Death Blow is good.
One of my favorite Elaine bits is when she goes to see Sack Lunch.
Yeah.
Is it a really big bag or do they just shrink down? something I love, just the fake movies make me so happy for some reason. I can't quite explain.
And movies being important to their day-to-day life makes me happy.
Yeah,
well,
that adds up.
Because that is something that I think was, at that time, very, like, a part of culture and has kind of disappeared. You know?
People caring about movies?
People caring about the types of movies that they care about. Like, it's just, like, the popular movies. And also, I assume Rochelle is kind of a more artful thing. There's like a very big city able to see these sorts of movies thing tied into it. But at least they have like two or three friends that they can talk about a movie with, you know? Whereas I very frequently see something and just have a very hard time finding anybody to talk about it with, you know? Whereas at least... Like, even sometimes with you, like, the person that, like, into microphones, we talk about movies every week.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know, it's just something interesting throughout the show, and it's obviously something that hits me in the heart.
Yeah.
It's the only thing about Seinfeld that gets me, you know? Or it gets my heart. The Seinfeld gets me, absolutely. But.
I do love the title Blimp, the hidden
text. Oh, it's so good.
It's such a goofy word for such a heavy movie. Yeah. Enjoy. Blame it on the rain? Oh, okay. Anything else about coffee table books? About coffee tables?
No.
Okay. What's next?
The face painter.
The face painter.
Welcome to Putty.
Another fantastic guest star.
Yeah. And not even anywhere near the best putty. I feel like you get a lot of really great putty in season 9. Like, he's still working out the putty kinks in this episode. Yeah.
Oh, there is this simultaneous complete aloofness and complete intensity with Putty. Like, he somehow walks the line between being so engaged with everything, like this intensity, but also not caring at all.
Yeah.
Like, when he gets dumped, no way, you gotta be kidding me. Like, he seems so sincere, but it also seems so flippant at the same time.
I think one of my favorite parts of the episode is him being like, I gotta go to change for the game. I'll be back. We'll make out. So good. Oh. And he's walking away as he says it.
Yeah. Oh, he has when he says he'll stop doing the face painting for Elaine and she's touched by it.
Yeah.
And he kind of asks, you know, you do that for me. That's right, he gives. Like, I don't know how you do so much with that line, which is just nothing. It is just so, so spot on.
Yeah, everybody did. Still making money off of it too. So good for him.
Good.
Doing the thing. Budget rent a car or whatever car rent. I think it's Enterprise maybe that he works for. Just going full putty.
And this is another one where a death is handled without any gravity, where someone adjusts their toupee and crashes. A reference to an old episode with the toupee. And it's just played for laughs. Like, there's just no weight to it at all.
Yeah, and when they're actually at the funeral, like, the sounds of crying are so prominent in the mix, like, that they want you to know that these people are just ignoring what's happening around them, you know, even though that is a funeral.
Yeah, you can't ignore it, but these people, your four people, are definitely capable of giving no fucks about
that. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that's of course a scene that I enjoy a lot. And also, speaking of, you know, that's sort of a societal rule, and something that George talks about is the funeral hello, which is nice. But also the episode revolves around, how many thank yous he's supposed to give for the tickets. And I love the scene in the diner and how hard they hit those thank yous. And then there's just no joke at the end of that. I like when Seinfeld does stuff like that, where it's like,
there's a payoff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, there's no line yet or no laugh yet, but it'll come eventually.
And I think that's something they got, like, as I said, with the pen, like, that's all just upfront laughs. And it's all, you know, it is things that are built on other things, but everything that's put forward is put forward for a laugh immediately almost. Whereas this, they have the patience to do a couple scenes where, or a couple lines where you don't get the payoff yet, but it's built in and it's going to be great when you get there.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I mean, we've talked about it a lot by now. It's just the whole episode is people being at odds with societal rules that we've all quietly agreed upon, you know? Like, you sit quietly and think about the dead person at a funeral, you know? Like, you call and thank somebody for giving you really good seats to a play. It seems like a playoff game, I think.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they're like, Kramer even has the line late in the episode, like, don't you want to be a part of society? Like, in society, there are some rules. And it's like, it ties back into some of the stuff that I love so much about the Chinese restaurant, is that, like, there are just things that you have to deal with, you know? Like, they might be mildly inconvenient to you, but in order to have a better life, you kind of have to put up with them.
You're not allowed to hiss at a priest who's
Asian. Yeah.
Like, that's one of the ones where it doesn't quite add up. Like, you see what they're going for, but him to just devils and then straight up hiss at the guy. Yeah. It's so funny. But delivered by Putty, it's all good. The ancestor of Dennis Duffy from 30 Rock, without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. What happens if they get in a scene together? What happens to us? God. Like, do we just explode?
The universe
explodes. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's... do you have another... favorite boyfriend or girlfriend?
Throughout? I mean, Putty takes the cake.
Yeah, I think he has to, right?
Well, okay, if we're talking, if we can get Jerry into the mix, Jeannie Steinman, for sure.
Yeah.
We'll talk about her.
Yeah, surprise.
even aside from it being Janine Garofalo, I love that episode. That was one of my ones on the list. But no, I think it's just, it's Putty. It's Putty, and then a very large gap, and then a bunch of other people.
It's gotta be,
like, right? There's so many talented people, and I mean... I don't know. I don't have anything.
No, there's a reason why he comes back in a way that we don't see X's come back.
And it becomes basically a fifth character of the show for part of the ninth season. Yeah.
What's next?
Soup Nazi.
Soup Nazi.
Yeah.
Okay, so we touched on this a little bit already.
Yeah.
This is probably the single episode, though,
right? I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because the contest is big, but it's still a little taboo maybe for everybody to get behind.
Mm-hmm.
And Chinese Restaurant just doesn't have that. I love that episode.
Yep.
It doesn't have that big moment. It doesn't have the quotability.
Yeah. Absolutely. And this episode, like you said, the quotability, and also like a very humorous performance happening at the same time as the quotability. Like, it's, and I think not that anything's wrong with that, has that element too, like the way the hands go up, like, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
But the Soup Nazi is just such a performative role, and it really adds in an extra element of fun, even though the things that he is saying are just so funny by themselves.
Yeah, and that I've seen this episode so many times, and, you know, these shows are only 22 minutes, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just the first time they go in there, I was like, I kind of forgot whether anyone gets their soup taken away right away. Yeah. And obviously it does, because there's not that much time to build to it. Yeah. But I was like, oh, I hope someone gets their soup taken. Like, it's still so much fun, and it's still so big and good.
Yeah, and when George gets the soup taken away, it's so funny. And, like, I think the totally underrated aspect of that sequence is the woman at the cash register.
Yeah.
Like, so, like, such a great performance in for 2 seconds, you know, and that's all she gets. I think that's the only time she's on screen, and it's just great. Her taking the soup and handing back the money, like, the handing back the money is so great. It's like, no, we have principles. You didn't get soup, you get your money back. That's fun. But yeah, it's an incredibly funny episode.
Yeah. It's also the Schmoopy episode.
Yeah, exactly. Schmoopy was something that I had totally not heard anything.
Oh, really?
About. Yeah.
Oh, I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And the affection showdown in the diner is pretty funny.
Oh, and George is just nauseating when he starts his up.
And then he actually has to start dealing with the repercussions from it.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. And it's just one of those things about relationships and... like this level of affection was like, it did him in, you know, like to show affection like that has just had this huge negative effect on his whole life. And how much Susan really appreciated and how it was just out of spite, you know, like she takes it so well, but it's the only time anyone really likes what George has done when he's acting purely out of spite and purely just not to make him, not because he wants to be like that with her, not because he knows she would like that, but just to, you know, to one up his friend and kind of shut him up.
As Elaine says in The Betrayal, spite never sleeps.
That's right. And this is another one. George and Susan is the best example, but it happens with Jerry and it happens with Elaine. Not so much with Kramer because he doesn't date that much. But just this idea of relationships to be something to escape.
Yeah.
Like just the idea of this prison. And obviously Susan's plotline is the best example, but... Oh, yeah. But just difficulty breaking up, you know, the timing of a breakup being bad is so often that every relationship is seen as just inconvenience to be escaped. Mm-hmm. And it just, there's just this view of romantic love that this show paints is just so incredibly dark and cold that, you know, you see it here, the schmoopiness, all the negative effects that has, the soup being taken away, which is the worst thing that could happen, at least in the world of this episode. Yeah.
Despite the fact that Elaine goes out, like, purposely shuts down this business.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And even just friendships. I mean, it's Soup Nazi and Kramer have struck up an odd friendship, and one of the many weird Kramerisms where he has this confidence and likability to him that it just can't be explained.
Yeah.
But the Soup Nazi, you know, ends up this guy who's really cold and, you know, seen as this really bad guy towards everyone, he lightens up and he gives this act of kindness by passing on the armoire to Elaine, and that's what does him
through Kramer.
Through Kramer, but, you know, and that's what ends his business. I mean, it's being kind to other people, like having compassion and giving something to someone is what ruins your life.
Yeah.
And it's just this dark, dark drawing of human interaction and human kindness having negative effects on you.
Yeah, exactly. He just felt bad that the street toughs took the arm.
Larry David wrote those characters as gay because he said only gay people would steal an armoire from someone. I like those two a lot.
I think they're incredibly funny. I would imagine some modern people have problems with those characters.
Yeah.
I just think the performance, especially Yul Vasquez, I think he is just so funny that even though he's playing multiple stereotypes at the same time that are probably offensive, maybe they cancel each other out or something. I don't know. And there are a couple, I can't remember any other specific examples, but there are a couple times throughout Seinfeld's run where it's kind of homophobic in a way that the 90s kind of just was a homophobic decade. You know,
not quite Eddie Murphy in the 80s, but not quite today.
Yeah, exactly. I find those guys just so funny. Their performances are so funny.
I don't know the other guy's name, but when he kind of starts things off, because you don't expect it, because he's kind of looking more nebbish, and you think the other one's the aggressive one, and then But when he does kind of throw his weight around and say, oh, I guess you were talking to me, like, you do kind of get that sense from him that there is something under the surface. And I think it's a good performance. And he doesn't have that big stereotypical, like,
yeah,
you know, he's gay, but whatever, like, it's not played up as this big flamboyant loud kind of guy. I think it's done really well.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a couple. Which one is it? One of the J. Peterman ones where Elaine's fake boyfriend gets addicted to heroin.
Yeah.
In the original airing of that episode, he calls heroin the Chinaman's nightcap.
Okay.
And you're not allowed to say that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was one. And there's been a few moments like that where things kind of just had to be tidied up, and you'll notice in any subsequent airings, you don't get that.
Mm-hmm.
And most famously and most controversial would be the Puerto Rican Day Parade of a flag being burned.
Yeah.
Obvious no-no.
Mm-hmm. Seinfeld, they're on top of the world.
That's right, they could do anything. Yeah. Anything else about the soup Nazi, though?
Not really. I
think it's all there, you know?
Like, I can't imagine what could be, like, more me than, or something, like, more going after my very specific interests than Elaine doing an Al Pacino impression.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But yeah, when I watched that episode, because I had actually never seen that episode outside of the clips, but the things that I hadn't seen before were the things that weren't No Soup for You.
Yeah,
you
know? I watched this episode of someone who hadn't seen it either, and obviously was aware of the soup Nazi. But Elaine ordering when she's just tapping on the top, I was the most excited about that part because, as I said, I love when all the No Soup for You stuff. That episode has a lot of good moments. Kramer being scared when the armoire is taken is really funny.
Him walking in and just taking the couch cushion and saying, yeah.
Yeah.
And walking out.
Yeah. No, I mean, all the schmoopy stuff is really funny to me, and the way George gets done in by his spite is good. But there was nothing I was more excited about than seeing her order the first time and, like, gagging at the sight of some of it and tapping on the counter and him putting up with it for just long enough. And yeah, I think you've been saying more positive things about Elaine than I have been. But
yeah.
I just need to throw in the fact that she is absolutely stellar during the entire run of this show.
Yeah, of course. It's just that, like, it's what I talked about earlier. Like, I find Elaine to be the most interesting character because she actually kind of reflects reality the most frequently. And so I spend the most time thinking about her.
One of the reasons.
Well, and also she's very talented. So it's the fact that her talent is tied into her being able to seem natural doing such horrible things.
Yeah.
You know, it just sort of makes everything about the character better.
Yeah. Oh, because she's just so ridiculously charming.
Yes. Unbelievably. Yeah. Like, just, and I don't know what it is. It might, like, you're going to laugh when I say this. I think it might be the dimensions of her body or part of it, because she's got such a tiny body, large head, and, like, huge hair, and she just looks so uncommon.
It's a wall. I want a wall of it.
But, yeah, just, I just think, I mean, I think every performer on the show elevates the already pretty great material that they've been given.
Yeah.
But I think Elaine, at least for me specifically, she really, I think I would have thought about Elaine a lot less if it was pretty much anybody else.
Right? Yeah.
Like, even somebody that with 90% of the talent that Julia
drives. It is the most dynamic character, but it is the most dynamic performance.
So yeah.
It's that. And I was, again, I don't know if it was this one or another Seinfeld, but I was just watching Seinfeld with someone younger than me who kind of knew about Seinfeld and what it was, but I think had seen very little. And the first time she did a Get Out push, they were losing their minds. I'm like, yeah, there's a bunch of those, and they're all somehow fantastic in their own way.
Yeah, and I think I love the Get Out push. It's like, I can't imagine five things that I would like to experience more in my life than an Elaine Get Out push. But, like, I think it really also speaks to the character, where it's just like, it's speaks to how self-obsessed she is, where it's just like she has to get out this this, like, emotion that you've made her feel, and she's just, her reaction is to physically harm you.
Good news or bad news.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I love that. Even apart from the fact that it's always pretty funny.
Yeah.
And I think it says a lot about her character, you know? Like, she's just gonna just get you.
Yeah.
Like, she's having a reaction and you have to deal with
it. Yeah, and she's so little too, again. That
yeah,
helps.
Exactly.
This is some good, not a ton of Newman in here, but some good Newman and soup Nazi.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's always good Newman when there's Newman.
Yeah, we have just haven't talked about him yet. How do you feel?
Love Newman.
Yeah?
So funny.
I didn't know if it would be too much of kind of a caricature or...
No.
No?
Like, it's just... I think he's just such a funny performer. I like Hello Newman.
16 times you hear Hello Newman.
That's it? Yeah. It's funny, actually, like... Even before I saw the show, like, again, my parents were big Seinfeld fans. Like, my mom very frequently says to me, Hello Newman, when we're talking. Like, when I'm like, Hello Mother, she's like, Hello Newman. You know, like, it's just, like, and that thing that Seinfeld was so popular that it invaded culture even to a child that didn't watch the show, yeah. You know? And I certainly would have guessed that you get more than 16 Hello Newmans, you know?
Yeah.
Because it was just so prominent, you know? It was such a thing. And I don't even know how it would have become a thing. It just seems like something they wouldn't have done a second time, you know?
Yeah, and on I'm Telling You for the Last Time, Jerry's stand-up album, where it was after Seinfeld, he was kind of getting rid of his old material and resetting.
Mm-hmm.
The very last track is just a Q&A, and someone just asks, can we get a Hello Newman? And he kind of breaks down everything about it, and, you know, you open the door, and you give him... space to make that little step inside that he does, and then, you know, I'm not gonna...
finally the inside the actor studio with Jerry Seinfeld, we've all been clamoring for.
Yeah, the man who knows the craft of acting,
Lee Strasberg.
That was just I just came across that 16 number, and you just think it must have been an every time Newman showed up, yeah. But it's just not. It just sticks out.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't think that Newman's in that much more than 16 episodes either, right?
Yeah, you mentioned the 200 number. I think it's 168 or 169, yeah. Believe it or not. but it's somewhere around there. And yeah, so for him to be in a tenth of the episodes does seem heavy, right?
Yeah.
But in there, sometimes you get the Goodnight Newman when they're in his bedroom and things like that. So there's some ways.
What's the episode where Kramer and Newman are just in Jerry's bedroom?
That's the one I was just thinking of, because yeah. He says Goodnight Newman. Yeah. It's one I just watched, so it's on this list,
yeah,
somewhere.
Yeah, it must be on this list. I don't remember which one it is.
They're scheming something. One of their many schemes. Oh, it's the rickshaw
one.
Yeah,
the rickshaw.
What's that?
I don't remember.
Yeah. Potato salad. That's what it's called.
The Invitations?
Yeah. All right. So this is one of your picks.
Yeah. I love Jeannie Steinman. I think the
well, this is another kind of two-hander. Like, it's good on its own, and then there's also that plot
exactly
line,
which,
you know?
Is again a plot line I knew nothing about. I didn't know Jeannie Garofalo ever made an appearance in Seinfeld. What was that? Was that like a bad
No, just okay. How much you love Jeannie Garofalo. No, not that I hate that,
yeah.
Just that she's on something so good and you didn't know she
yeah
was there.
And is so good in it. And it's like
just doing her Jerry.
Yeah, exactly. It's a Jeannie Garofalo. Sorry, I like. We need to be very clear. There's good Jeannie Garofalo and bad Jeannie Garofalo, and there's so little of Jeannie Garofalo's career that I actually really enjoy experiencing.
Okay.
But like when she's in something that I actually like she's just wonderful.
Was she the female Jerry Seinfeld before that, and that's how she got the role?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. She's certainly. I think. I don't think she's as close to Jerry as you might think, but I think she kind of has that
her roles. I mean,
yeah,
yeah.
She has that kind of removed vibe that would definitely.
She's removed. She's very kind of, and I'm speaking about the roles I've seen her in,
mm-hmm.
not her. She's very removed, as you said. She's very kind of plain spoken and direct.
Yep.
Doesn't really pull any punches. Doesn't seem to be going out of her way to hurt people, but can say things that some people would find hurtful,
yep.
Just very matter-of-factly, which I think is very Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun in this.
Yeah.
And she comes out swinging, like, it's a very small performance, you know what I mean? Like, she's playing someone who, you know, Jerry is not the big, loud character.
Yeah.
It's not a Kramer, but just... saves a man's life, and then is quickly like, oh, that's a waste. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Immediately gets onto his shirt choice and yeah. How much of his collar is exposed. Like, it was literally a life-saving moment 30 seconds ago, and now you're critiquing, like, millimeters of collar, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I just enjoy the whole aspect of, since the show has so heavily featured Jerry constantly looking, and talking about he's looking, you know, he's going for the record.
Yeah.
And the thing that finally gets him, and I mean, we just talked about Schmoopy. He would seem pretty dedicated to Schmoopy at a time,
yeah.
But that seems to be a relationship that lasts weeks tops, you know?
Yeah.
But he proposes to Jeannie Steinman pretty immediately because he found somebody that is him. And yeah. I love that. I love the way that he comes to both realizations. I think one of what we talked about is Golden Boy performance. Another one of my favorite Jerry moments is when he realizes that he's been waiting for me to, like he says, I've been waiting for me to come along.
Yeah.
And now I've swept myself off my feet. I think that's so funny and he absolutely kills it. And all of that stuff makes me really happy. And just the idea of a character realizing that the reason they haven't found anybody they're happy with is because they haven't found themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sweet episode in a lot of ways, or at least that plot line of it is pretty sweet. Not Susan's death, but the JS on JS Cheerios love is pretty good. And, you know, you see Jerry happiest with a girl that you ever really see him, mm-hmm. You know, Schmoopy, and I think there's another one where people are gaga about something.
Yeah.
And it feels sweet and nice and kind of affirming in a way that of romantic relationships in a way that you rarely get out of Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
But it truly is so anti-relationship.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's you're not looking for someone, you're looking for yourself. And you know, that's the opposite of sharing your life with someone. It's just doing the things that you've done them your whole life over and over. And then there is kind of that even darker turn when he finds out I can't be with myself. Yeah. I hate myself.
No, exactly. Like, that's another thing I love.
Yeah, it looks like a good relationship thing, and then it takes a turn into an anti-relationship thing, and then it takes a turn into like an anti-existence kind of thing.
Yep.
Within 20 minutes.
Yeah.
With a bunch of jokes and two other plot lines mixed in.
Yeah. But yeah, it's another one of those episodes that I just really like, and from like a thinking about outside of the episode sort of perspective.
Yeah.
I just enjoy that stuff.
And Happy Jerry is fun when you see him, too. Exactly. Like when they're at the bar ordering drinks and George shows up and that they're engaged and things like that. And, you know, I think it kind of shows a bit of the signs of doing, you know, the quote, a show about nothing for so long, the way that they both kind of get fed up with talking about the minutiae.
Yeah.
And you just imagine there must be some frustration in, you know, for Seinfeld and Larry David and any of the writers and directors and things like that of finding another small thing to base an episode around, you know?
Yeah. I also kind of love that this was Larry David's kind of farewell Jerry plot line, that it's like, this is the last thing I have to say about Jerry. I find so funny.
What's he saying about Jerry that you like?
I think it's just like that he's just watching his friend date all these people, and he knows that he's just looking for himself or whatever and just can't find it. And when he does find it, he's going to hate himself. Yeah. Because Larry David is the sole credited writer on this episode. Right?
I think so, yeah.
Because the later you get the show, the less frequently Jerry is credited as a writer, you know, just because he's now a superstar. I find it really fascinating from that angle as well. Like, if either of us wrote that episode about the other, how weird that would be at the table read, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting, and I like that episode. I like thinking about it. I like I really like the scene where Jerry is starting to get annoyed with Jeannie. I think that scene's great.
Yeah.
Even, you know, when he vocalizes that he hates himself is good, but like him realizing these things, like that he does hate himself, is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Or that he just, you know, at times is like, God damn it, I wish I could get away from myself. You know?
Yeah. And I think that is,
which is another very real thing that every adult will think of.
Yeah. But no, for the way that Larry David does leave after that, it is kind of a nice conclusion to this, you know, multi-season Jerry plotline. Like I was saying before, he's kind of been the fly on the wall, or the one kind of looking down at all of his friends kind of battling this out and trying to be happy with other people and getting in arguments and, you know, struggling with romantic relationships. And then this one really kind of comes around where, you know, Jerry does kind of really dip his toe into something and realize he's not above everybody, and that he, there is this kind of darkness that I got what I wanted.
Yep.
And it sucks. Like, I was kind of on this pedestal watching you guys battle it out. I'm just looking. I'm not seriously invested in looking, at someone as a real life partner.
Yeah.
And then that depressing idea of finding it and having it be ultimately very disappointing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So as Larry David leaves the show, I think we should leave part two. I think we're transitioning into part three, looking at the list of episodes we have remaining.
Yeah, and so that's the end of season six?
Seven.
That's the end of season seven. Yeah, when Larry David left. Yeah. And this is kind of a cross season two-parter into The Invitation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we should... The reason I really love... we didn't even talk about The Invitation. We just talked about Jeannie. We didn't talk about... We still have to talk about the rest of this. And then we'll end part two. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead. Yeah, Susan dies in this episode.
Yes, she does. One of the... Well, not one of, I guess, other than Elaine, the longest partner of any of our main characters.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess Putty did kind of come and go, but our longest real relationship.
Yeah, I mean, she's probably, throughout the show's run, she's probably the person that makes the fifth most appearances, right?
I wonder about that.
I would think so. She's in a lot of episodes.
She is in a lot of episodes. Newman,
no. We had 16. We established this. Well, Susan's got to be in more than 16 episodes.
Okay, yeah. All right.
But yeah, also, like, I love George trying to get out of the relationship, like, this ties into a lot of what we've talked about earlier, him talking about a plane crash and Jerry being like, you know, it's like one in a million. He's like, but still, that's hope.
Yeah,
like,
there's hope.
About my fiance dying in a plane crash. And like him proposing the idea of a prenup to Susan is so
that's
funny.
Good. That's Susan's best, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Like, she doesn't, she's get a lot so to work funny with,
but that's good.
She's so funny in that moment. Yeah, no, it's
oh, and even George taking up smoking, like taking on this gradual suicidal act in order to get out of a loving relationship. Yeah. And it seems that Susan is nothing but sweet to George.
Yeah, exactly. Susan doesn't seem like a bad person.
No, we never get that.
Yeah. But yeah, it's also really funny that she dies because he's cheap. Like, I think that's really funny.
Yeah. So we can end part two there. There is kind of a part two of, like, this is the finale of season seven and the intro to the, you know, debut of season eight are very closely linked. So, little cliffhanger for you guys.
Yeah, exactly. So what we will do, just like they do at the end of The Invitations, let's go get some coffee, I guess.